points on today's show. In New Brunswick, Green Party MLA Megan Mitten says she'll keep an eye on Susan Holt's newly elected Liberal government.
You know, the devil's in the details, and so I'm looking forward to seeing some numbers and seeing some timelines around some of the promises that the government is making.
To Montreal, where a Mohawk group says McGill University is to blame for the removal of a white pine peace tree planted on their grounds just a few days ago.
Reconciliation is not just some rhetoric on a website, but reconciliation comes with reparations. And so we are taking our form of reparations in regards to our right to control what happens on our homelands, and this is our homelands.
High-speed internet will soon bridge the gap between Manitoba's rural communities and larger markets.
We deserve the same rights and services and programs like any other Canadian that enjoys living in a free world.
Nanaimo's new poet laureate is looking forward to sharing world poetry in language with this community.
I think I'm just at a juncture in my life where advocating for the arts just feels really, really compelling and really important.
Local farmers who want to stay on the cutting edge of agricultural innovation could get help from the Experimental Acres funding program. And St. John's artist Cheryl Crowley introduces the community to her art project, Our True Selves. Welcome to Viewpoints Local News Nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Boris Chassin, and I'll be with you for the next half hour and in good company with our journalists posted across the country. We kick off the show in New Brunswick, where the newly elected Liberal government will be closely watched by Green Party MLA Megan Mitten. We're going to need to do multiple things to address multiple crises, says Mitten. The Sackville Green Party MLA says there were no surprises in last Tuesday's throne speech outlining plans for the Holt's Liberal government. Mitten says she will continue to focus on healthcare, affordability, and infrastructure concerns in the New Brunswick legislature. Here's part of Erica Butler's conversation with Mitten as she shares her reactions to the throne speech.
Megan Mitten, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
The last time we spoke to you, you did say you were feeling a bit hopeful about the beginning of, you know, getting back in the legislature and starting to see things happen. Are your hopeful feelings being rewarded by what you see happening so far?
Well, I mean, I'm still going to hang on to that hope. There are some things in here that at first glance sound good, but, you know, the devil's in the details. And so I'm looking forward to seeing some numbers and seeing some timelines around some of the promises that the government is making. And so I'm going to be looking for the details of what they're going to do in terms of healthcare, for example, housing, and other things like that.
Do you see some of these initiatives as, you know, like the more important and things that you'd like to see happen as soon as possible?
I don't think anyone's surprised to hear me say we have a major crisis in healthcare. We have an affordable housing crisis, an affordability crisis, and we have a climate change crisis. And so with this situation we are in, we do need some transformative action to be taken. They are mentioning collaborative care clinics, which is something that, you know, I've been calling for years. We already have one that is really starting to develop in Tantramar, which I'm glad about. I'm seeking more details on what they mean. We will need infrastructure money for that. And so I'm already talking to the Minister of Health about that and about him visiting Tantramar and Strait Shores to see what's going on and how, you know, the Minister of Health can support what we need in our communities in terms of healthcare.
On the affordability front, we will be seeing a 3% rent cap come in. That's close to what was in the Green platform, what you were proposing. Do you have any cautions or things that you'll be looking out for as that comes forward?
So that bill will be tabled on Wednesday, and so we'll see the details of it then. But it is similar to what we were pushing for, and I mean, we've been calling for a rent cap, for years. The other piece of what I really want to see are protections for tenants, against retaliation. I'm planning to meet with the Minister of Housing to discuss, what else is needed and offer suggestions about where we can go to better support nonprofits and cooperatives and non-market housing, because that's really where we should be focusing right now. Some of the things that I'm going to be bringing up this fall will be healthcare, absolutely. Housing is another thing. This Toronto speech was really light on transportation and infrastructure talk. I do have a meeting with the Minister of Transportation and Infrastructure next week, and on our agenda will be things like the Chignecto Isthmus, which was not mentioned in this Throne speech, the Wheaton Covered Bridge, as well as Route 955 being part of their capital asset plan. And so even if some things don't come up in the legislature, I'll be working on them outside of the legislature in meetings with ministers, for example. I'll keep my eye on things, and hopefully we can do another update to once things have rolled out a bit.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Erica.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
To Montreal, Quebec, where a group of Mohawk women and their supporters gathered at McGill University on Saturday, November 16, to plant a white pine sapling in a call for peace. But by Monday morning, that tree was gone. The group, who call themselves Ungwe Hungwe Kunungwe, says McGill is likely to blame. The ceremony was an unsanctioned commemoration of the pro-Palestine encampment that once stood in McGill's lower field, and a call for peace both in Gaza and on the ancestral territories of the Haudenosaunee people where McGill University now stands. The university did not confirm that it was their workers who uprooted the sapling. McGill, however, stated that their commitment to the spirit of reconciliation is enduring, but they retained the right to determine how university property is used. Details with Jules Brugiel in Montreal.
A group of Mohawk women gathered at McGill on Sunday to plant a white pine sapling. But by Monday morning, that tree was gone. The group says McGill is likely to blame. The day before, Mohawk land defender Gunasikwa Selin-Gabriel spoke to the crowd of over 100, explaining that the pine tree was planted as a symbol of peace.
As the title holders to the land, the women decided that we are going to put a tree of peace here. We are here as well because on our homeland, we saw students being beaten up, pepper sprayed, silenced. That's not going to happen on our watch.
The pine was planted on the edge of McGill's lower field, just steps away from where a pro-Palestinian encampment once stood before being dismantled by private security this summer. Here's Zaina Karim speaking on behalf of Students for Palestinian Honor and Resistance, one of the groups behind that encampment.
We, the student movement, would like to thank the women of the Ganyangahaga Nation for this gift of peace, the planting of the Great White Pine. We are together through these difficult times, and we honor this gift by raising our voices with yours for peace and justice.
In a statement, the university confirmed that they were aware of the plan to plant the tree, an action they cited a number of reasons for not approving. The most fundamental being that, quote, the university's authorization is required for the modification of its property. But in an email obtained by CKUT, McGill senior administrators Fabrice Labeau and Christopher Manfredi also told the group that McGill's reconciliation efforts are, quote, carried out in partnership and consultation with the traditional and elected leadership of local Indigenous communities. The group in question is not affiliated with the Mohawk Nation at Ganawage. Still, Gabriel told CKUT that it's not up to McGill who gets to speak for Mohawk people.
You know, we, as the title holders of this land, do not follow the colonial status quo of Band Council. And we are able to speak for ourselves as sovereign individuals under a sovereign nation, sovereign peoples. It's not up to McGill to decide who's going to speak on our behalf. It's totally not up to them. Just as we would never tell McGill who's going to speak for them.
Personally, I disagree with the fact that a settler institution should be dictating the terms of reconciliation when they are the ones actively still occupying our territory.
Speaking now is Guru Hanorun, a graduate student in anthropology at McGill, who was also part of the Mohawk or Ganangahaga Nation. They told CKUT that the removal of the tree isn't an isolated incident, but speaks to a larger trend in how McGill approaches Indigenous students generally, and the Mohawk community in particular.
This has not been a place where I feel necessarily welcomed or supported by the administration because of the way that they are oriented in their relationship with my people, which I guess sounds a bit abstract, and I wish I could explain it more clearly than that, but it feels very much like McGill imposes itself on Ganyankehaga students, on Ganyankehaga people that live in the island, that live in Ganawage, Agwazasne, Ganasitage. An example I can give maybe that's a bit more concrete is this semester I wanted to take a Ganyankeha class, and I had to persuade the graduate program supervisor in anthropology to let me take the class because it had an undergraduate course code and I'm a graduate student, and I had to argue why I should be allowed to learn my own language on campus. And that was definitely really frustrating, especially seeing all these emails that come out and McGill publicly presenting itself as being in front of reconciliation, as leading reconciliation.
McGill told CKUT in a statement that the university's commitment to reconciliation is enduring. Online, you can find the progress they've made on 52 calls to action, established in 2017. But they've also been in a prolonged legal battle with a group who call themselves the Mohawk Mothers. It's a group of women who are fighting to have McGill conduct an expert-led search of the new Vic site for unmarked graves. A key request in that fight has been for McGill to treat the women as leaders and partners in that search. Many familiar faces showed up on Sunday for a ceremony with a similar demand.
Reconciliation isn't not just some rhetoric on a website or creating programs where there's certificates of social work or certificates of teaching, but reconciliation comes with reparations. And so we are taking our form of reparations in regards to our right to control what happens on our homelands. And this is our homelands.
McGill refused an interview with CKUT and did not by press time confirm that their workers were the ones who removed the sapling. I'm Jules Bijal, reporting with the Local Journalism Initiative. Thanks for listening.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
The city of Nanaimo is welcoming its new poet laureate. His name is Neil Sirkin. Sirkin is an English professor at Vancouver Island University, and he has an extensive list of published works, including his newest chapbook entitled Ruined, published in 2023. Sirkin says he is excited about his new role and his two-year term as Nanaimo's poet laureate. His new job will start on December 1st, and soon after, on December 5th, he will kick off the Harborfront Library Poetry Showcase, accompanied by Youth Poet Laureate Paige Pierce. Lauren McKenzie in Nanaimo, British Columbia.
I was obsessed with the idea of playing music live, and that was my goal actually when I went started at university. I just wanted to be a musician, and then I took a modern poetry course. It was my first ever university course in English, and I fell in love with the difficulty or the complexity of it. And so I started writing my own stuff.
He says it took another 10 years before he started sending out publication inquiries for his work and fell more deeply in love with poetry and the act of writing it.
I think my first book, which was called On High, came out in 2018, was still just writing a series of almost love letters to the poets who had kind of lit me up. And it wasn't until this second collection that came out in 2021 called Unbecoming, where I really found that my own voice started to feel true, I think, and that came down in a lot of ways to having a child. So when my son was born, I just suddenly realized that a different kind of frankness was required of me. I wanted to just show up in the world in a way that I could be proud of to my son.
He says he applied for the Poet Laureate position as he is invested in getting his neighbors and wider community into having conversations about the language they use and how poetry allows people to find new ways to express themselves.
And I just want to invite people into that, because often I hear, especially around poetry specifically, that people are like, oh, it's not for me. I don't really know how to engage with that form or that kind of writing. And I always just see it as our most precise language. And so I think of it in every conversation where we're trying to convey something we really mean. That's our opportunity to speak to one another more deeply.
He says that as the Poet Laureate, he's interested in shifting the idea of offering poetry to the community by instead inviting the community to engage with it themselves.
So my goal is to kind of sprinkle the wider city with little opportunities to stop and reflect on our own histories and contexts while we're in a definitive place. So thinking about the histories and the contexts of this place alongside what we bring in our own stories.
He says having a Poet Laureate for the city is important because now is the time to pay attention to the weight that words have and to engage with how complex they can be to convey a message.
And so I think that that's something that everyone should be invited to engage with and to reckon with, because it's a tricky reckoning. And I think it can also just lead to so many illuminating and inspiring moments in our personal lives when we think about the role of the poem in our own vicinity. So I want to bring that to the city. I want to advocate for it. I think I'm just at a juncture in my life where advocating for the arts just feels really, really compelling and really important. And I just feel so delighted that I get to have the opportunity to put that forth. I'm so excited to hear the language that y'all are going to create together. And I'm so excited just to hear the stories of your lives as you start to craft your own poems.
This is Neil Sirkan reading a poem from an almost completed manuscript he is working on.
This is a poem called Endurance. And it's about looking toward the future. Endurance. Were grief a state of healing and not the act of paying attention to what will have been, what's now disappearing from the earth, I would teach you to believe in reflourishment. Instead, you must learn endurance in the face of all that won't be saved. My chick, who hatched among the egg-lumped coils of a dozing snake, while I clung to the nest and sang.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
A $38 million investment from the Canadian federal government will bring high-speed internet access to 14 rural and Indigenous communities in Manitoba. The announcement was made in Winnipeg by Dan Vandal, Minister of Northern Affairs and Minister responsible for the Canadian Northern Economic Development Agency. Edward Albert of Norway House Cree Nation Broadband Incorporated feels that this announcement could help level the playing field and open the door for new businesses and investments that might only have gone to larger urban centers such as Winnipeg or Brandon. And David Lee Roy Muswagon of the Pimicikamak Communications Corp says he's excited about the opportunities high-speed internet brings to his and other First Nation communities, and says his business could soon be able to compete with other Winnipeg markets. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
This initiative promises to enhance access to vital online resources, foster economic growth, and boost community safety, providing a foundation for new businesses and investments in areas traditionally overlooked in favor of larger urban centers like Winnipeg and Brandon. Edward Albert of Norway House Cree Nation Broadband Inc., one of the key partners in this effort, explains.
Connectivity is really something, I think, for our small community, our rural community, to connect with our big cities. You know, I think it's important that we send our services out to the world and what we have to offer, and I think that's important.
He emphasizes the potential of internet access to promote tourism and other economic opportunities.
Through internet, I think there's opportunity there for everybody in our community, even our businesses, definitely. I know that we just opened up the health center in our community, and I think it's important to have our connectivity in that area.
David Leroy Muswagon of Pimicikamak Cree Nation and Pimicikamak Communications Corps sees this as a long overdue step toward equality in services for Indigenous communities.
It's been a long time coming. This is an 18-year journey where we started in 2006, and we ran into all kinds of roadblocks and red tape and everything, but we were persistent. We didn't give up on our dream of providing objective standard communications infrastructure to our people. For far too long, there was disparity between Canadian standards and Indian standards. So we worked hard to bring this up to here, saying we deserve the same rights and services and programs like any other Canadian that enjoys living in a free world.
His organization, based in Cross Lake, has built its own infrastructure from the ground up, equipping them with the knowledge to differentiate themselves from larger providers.
Our goal is to eventually start off small, baby steps, and we're going to learn as we roll out, right? There's things that are going to work. There's things that are not going to work. So once we stabilize a solid foundation for a PIMCOM corporation, then we'll start gradually moving out to different, we'll start investing and dealing with different markets on different economic opportunities where we see value. For money, and where we see a value to benefit the corporation. And our long-term goal is to become a big player 20 years from now, where before I get too old and die, I want to see at least 100 of my young people working and taking ownership of their corporation and running it themselves.
The Honorable Dan Vandell, Minister of Northern Affairs, announced the initiative in Winnipeg, emphasizing that internet is no longer a luxury.
We must make sure that everyone has access to high-speed internet all over Manitoba and all over Canada. That's especially true in isolated communities, northern and rural communities, especially Indigenous communities that have historically been underserved.
The upgraded infrastructure will revolutionize daily life, improving telehealth access, enhancing online education, and enabling digital business opportunities. It also connects Manitoba's rural workforce to urban centers like Winnipeg, reinforcing the potential for remote work.
I was Northern Affairs Minister for about a month after the pandemic. Then the pandemic was declared. And within a few weeks after that, I would have early morning meetings in Yukon, late morning meetings in Northwest Territories, and late afternoon in Nunavut. And we were able to communicate and to work. The workforce itself, now we have a hybrid model where 50% of the time or 2 or 3 days a week, people work at home when they work for the federal government, provincial government, and I would think the city as well. So there's that, the ability to work from remote places.
Funded through the Universal Broadband Fund and Indigenous Services Canada, this initiative is part of a federal commitment to connect 98% of Canadian households to internet by 2026, and all by 2030. While only 85% of Manitobans currently have reliable high-speed internet, these projects, led by Indigenous communities, aim to create long-lasting benefits by prioritizing local leadership, expertise, and economic empowerment. I'm Ryan Funk.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints.
To Ontario now, where farmers looking to try new techniques or crops can now apply for a $3,000 grant offered by the county to help local farmers stay on the cutting edge of agricultural innovation. The intent of the Experimental Acres Funding Program is to help local farmers mitigate the risks of applying new regenerative agricultural practices, such as using cover crops to prevent soil erosion or building new greenhouses using new green technologies. Details with Arlene Dowell in Fergus, Ontario.
Experimental Acres lets farmers apply for grant funding of up to $3,000 to help with projects that could benefit their operations. Agriculture coordinator with the county, Jordan Griggs, says they are always looking for a wide variety of projects. She says they usually fall into three categories.
So we've had a lot of crop or planting projects that might include things like planting cover crops for the first time or looking at a more diverse mix of cover crop seeds that could be planted, as well as intercropping or other unique cropping techniques. We also have animal-related projects. So this is often rotational grazing or trying to bring animals back onto land where they've been removed from for a while. And then other projects kind of that don't fit neatly into those two categories, we put into innovation. And we've had a few different unique projects go through this stream. We've had some of them including tarping to break hay instead of using tillage to reduce the impact on the soil.
She says regenerative agriculture can be practiced in as many ways as there are farms. The project that was piloted in 2022 has produced many success stories. Greg says she continues to learn and appreciate the vision of area farmers.
So we worked this past year with a farm called Black Dog Acres in Guelph, Aramasa, and Doug, the farmer there, was using spent distiller's grains on his hay field and to reduce his reliance on fertilizer inputs. So it was a nice way to work with a local business to collect the distiller's grains, and then Doug was able to try out this practice on his farm, and we did some soil testing in the spring, and we'll be going back next spring to compare to see if it made any difference on the soil health parameters that we measured.
Generally more popular with smaller farms, Grig says all sizes of farming operations are welcome to apply.
When we say that we're a small-scale grants program, small-scale can mean a smaller farm or just a subsection of your farm so that you can test something out before expanding it to your whole operation.
She says applications are being accepted until January 19th and says in the past, funding for these projects has ranged from $500 to $3,000.
And in that process, we just ask about the current practices, what you would like to do as your experimental acre, and your approximate budget. And that helps us sort of know how many projects we can accept into the program.
Arlene Dowell with the Local Journalism Initiative.
And to close the show, St. John artist Cheryl Crowley just launched a new exhibit at the St. John City Market. Her community-based art project entitled Our True Selves was produced in collaboration with members of the community. Each person created art pieces on a small wooden disc to express who they felt their authentic selves to be. In the end, more than 90 illustrated wooden discs were produced and will be on display at the City Market for the next few weeks. Yona Coe in St. John, New Brunswick, spoke with her.
I asked them to think about who was their most authentic self inside, whether they showed it on the outside or not, and also to channel their five-year-old who loved to just play and make things. And we did three community events with all kinds of different art materials. And with those two ideas in their minds, children and adults then just had a great time decorating individual discs in the way that spoke to them at the moment. There was a Pride Market, and so many people came and decorated there. And we ended up with 95 discs. The children were more instantly up for it. The adults, some of the adults, it was a little bit harder to ask them to think of their five-year-olds, because we get so conditioned as adults about how we should do things and shouldn't do things. And the idea of just taking materials that call to them and playing with them and making something that was abstract sometimes took a little bit of persuading.
So that's it for us this week. Thanks to our journalists Arlene Dowell, Yona Coe, Erica Butler, Jules Bugiel, Lauren McKenzie, and Ryan Funk. Our national editors were Conrad Fox and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and, of course, your local radio station. Thanks for giving us a voice. By the way, remember to check out all our stories on frequencynews.ca. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Happy to have you with us this week, and until the next, ciao.